Okay, in the Slichas of Asarvateves, so the first piyut that we said in the Slichas mentions, like you were just pointing out, Dani, that there's really three things that happened this week and three consecutive days that we that are actually meant to be a fast. The 8th, the 9th, and the 10th. Now, we say it in the Slichas, we said it all this morning, but it's referred to, it's brought down in Shulchan Aruch. There's a simon in Shulchan Aruch, simon Tav Kuf Pei, which might very well be the least learned simon in Shulchan Aruch Arachayim. I say Arachayim. Of course, the other three halakim of Shulchan Aruch are altogether not learned by most people, but especially Chosh and Mishpat. But in Arachayim, we kind of, we like to think we learn it, more or less. Simon Tav Kuf Pei is the very last simon in Hilchos Tanyos, and it has a list of about two dozen days that it says a royal his anis behem, and they're all days that nobody ever heard of. This list, it goes back to the Bahag. The Bahag is a very early sefer from the time, from like the 700s of the Common Era, right after the times of the Gemara. And he brings down what some people call Megillas Tanis, a scroll, a list of Tanyos. Now, it's a little tricky, the expression Megillas Tanis.
Not Tanya.
But even Megillas Tanis is a tricky expression because there's two different Megillas Tanises. The real Megillas Tanis, meaning when the Gemara talks about Megillas Tanis, primarily in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, there's Gemaras elsewhere also that mention Megillas Tanis. That was a scroll that they had in the times of the Tanoim and Amoraim, which was a list of days that are Asur Lehesanis Behem, days that you're not allowed to fast because of happy events that happened on those days during the times of the Second Beis Hamikdash or around there. Most of them were not really of such lasting importance. And the Gemara Rosh Hashanah says, "Batl Megillas Tanis, Chutz Mechanical Purim." The only two days that we have left from the Megillas Tanis are Chanukah and Purim. But the Gemara in Tanis tells us what some of the others were. So that was the original Megillas Tanis, which was a list of days that you're not allowed to fast on. But in the later day race, in the times of the Ga'inim, there was a new Megillas Tanis, which was a list of days that it's Ro'i Lehisanis Bem, that you are supposed to fast. And it lists, it's a bunch of dates, and it has over there the yard sites of Moshe Rabbeinu, Aaron, Miriam. It has other events that has the day that Rabbi Akiva was arrested, was made into a fast day. It has the day that Yeravam ben Nevat stopped the Yidden from going up to Yushalayim, that was made into a fast day. And all of these are days that are royal asanis behem, and they're all brought down in the Shulchan Aruch and some Tav Kuf Pei, and all of them are really unknown to us. The Tanis that we have on our calendar, Shivas Batamas and Tisha B'Av and Sam Gedalia and Asar B'Teves and Tanis Esther, all of those are not there. They're not in Simen Tav Kuf Pei. They're mentioned elsewhere in Shulchan Aruch. But the Tanis and Simen Tav Kuf Pei are all random dates that are not used. And what's strange is that the Torah brings it down. The Beis Yosef, that's of Yosef Cairo, in his Pirush on the Torah, he writes, he says, this minig is entirely unknown nowadays. Nobody keeps this. And then he, Rav Yosef Cairo, he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, and he brought it all down. He brought it all down, just the way that the Torah did. He brought down this list of days that, I think the expression is, Sharoi Lesanis Ben, even though he didn't fast on those days, and he clearly didn't really mean to be endorsing that, because he wrote in the Beis Yosef that nobody does this. But I guess he meant to be preserving the knowledge of what were the days on the list. So you have this Simen Tav Kuf Pei, which is a list of about two dozen days, which were once considered days that are royal asanis behem, and they're not kept anymore. Now, for the most part, they're scattered across the calendar, one or two in each month. But when it comes to Teves, it has Ches and Tes and Yud Teves are all days that are royal asanis behem. Now, Yud is not mentioned over there because Yud, that's the Sar B'Teves, that's one of the major fasts that we have, Zecha L'Chorban, so that's mentioned elsewhere. That's some Tav Kuf Nun Aleph. But it mentions over there the 8th and the 9th of Teves. And what it says is very striking. Over there it says that the 8th of Teves, the reason why we fast is because that's the day that Talmai HaMelech ordered that the Torah be translated into Greek. And that was considered Yom Kashr L'Yisrael Kiyom Shanasa by Egel. And so it was declared to be a fast. That's the 8th. And the ninth, the Lashon of the Shulchan Aruch, which is the Lashon of the Tur, which is the Lashon of the Bahag, Loi Noida Al Matiknuhu. It's not known why they were masaking a fast on the ninth of Teves. So there's a mystery fast. A mystery fast yesterday, the ninth of Teves, where all the early sources say, Loi Noida Al Matiknuhu. Now, of course, there are some theories out there. The most well-known theory is what it says in the Slichas. In the Slichas, it doesn't say Loi Noida, it says on the 8th of Teves was the translation of the Torah. On the 9th of Teves is the Yahrzeit of Ezra HaSefer. That we fast because of the death of Ezra HaSefer, and that theory is plausible in the sense that it fits, because a lot of the other things in the Megillat Tanis are for Yahrzeits of prominent people, Moshe, Aaron, Miriam. Ezra HaSefer is considered by Chazal to be a very prominent person. He's considered like the second giving of the Torah is Ezra HaSefer. So that would make sense. Just what's very strange then is, so why all the mystery about it? Why doesn't it just say? Right, why, if that was why they made the fast, so how come it was forgotten until this Paitan came along and he was able to figure it out? And it doesn't seem like such a deep, dark mystery if this is the Pshat. So it's strange why it's Loi Noida Al Matiknuhu. The impression that I think a lot of people get from the Loi Noida Al Matiknuhu is that it's kind of like a wink, wink. It's not really Loi Noida, but we're not telling. That there was something secret about it that Chazal didn't want to share, or the Goyim, the Rishonim, whoever wrote this over, didn't want to share. It was a secret fast that the Jews had that was best kept under wraps. And if that's the pshat...
Okay. Fire alarm?
Or is it a secret?
If that's the pshat...
Kindness is over.
Okay. In Israel.
No, that's actually very good. There's an app that rings every time someone in the room is about to give away a secret. So if that's the pshat, then it would seem very likely that Tes Teves always falls out right around this time of year in the season, you know, in like tis the season kind of season. So maybe that's what it was for, that the original December 25th, of 2023 years ago, maybe fell out on Tes Teves. It's certainly the right time of year. Certainly, you know, you're talking, it's plausible. His birth would, you know, you could say was responsible for a tremendous amount of Jewish bloodshed over the centuries, more than anybody else probably, you know, people that were killed in his name. It certainly could be remembered as a dark day in Jewish history that the Jews... that were making fasts for all sorts of things. Like I said, you know, there's a lot of different major events in Jewish history, like prominent yard sites and the capture of Rabbi Akiva and Rav Menavot's rebellion. The birth of Yeshu, to be put onto that list doesn't seem so unlikely. And that they would try to keep it under wraps also is very mistabra. Obviously, you can't just go, you know, go write that in the Bahag, in the Torah, in the Shulchan Aruch, that is Roi L'Hasana, it's on the day that Yeshu was born. So this could be, again, there's no corroboration that it is, but it could be that this is what's meant by the Loi Noida, you know, but the mystery fast on the 10th of Teves. On the 9th of Teves. Now, it should be possible to try to figure it out. Go back, you know, with a calendar. Thing is, it's a little bit harder than it would seem. There is a tool online called Hebcal, which converts any date in any year from the Jewish calendar to the Goyish calendar. But it's not accurate once you go back before 1582, because that's when the Goyim changed their calendar and they subtracted 10 days. So the program can't really adjust for that. So, you know, so if you go to an earlier date... So that program is going to be off. And to say, okay, so just add 10 days or subtract 10 days is also not the solution, because the 10 days built up gradually over the course of many centuries. So I'm sure if you put in a lot of work and research, you should be able to figure out when was, you know, what was the English date of the 9th of Teves 2023 years ago. And then if it falls out on December 25th, then that would be a strong support for this theory. If it doesn't fall out December 25th, I still don't know if that would be such a strong kasha on the theory, because Lav Dafke, it was made up. In all likelihood, it wasn't made up then. I mean, when he was born, there was no reason to make a big deal about him. So it would have had to have come 100 years or 500 years or something later. And at that point, maybe whoever was doing it was approximating, and he thought that the 9th of Tevis might have been the date of December 25th.
The ten days should work if you go against the Greek Orthodox, the Orthodox.
Yeah, so we're going to come to them a little later in the shiur, actually.
That date should work, and then you could tell if it probably worked for the other one.
Right, they didn't change the calendar.
That's what changed.
Right, so we'll come to them a little later in the shiur.
They went from one to the other. And,
Why is it so bad that they wanted to translate into Greek?
That's a good question.
Wasn't the Torah translated to 70 Lashonos?
Yeah, that's excellent kasha. Maybe another time. We'll talk about that. That's a very good kasha, but we're staying off of that topic for today. So this is a rather intriguing idea, a possibility about what was meant by this fast of the 9th of Teves, and if it's true, so that fast, of course, you know, although it's in the Shulchan Aruch, but it's really fallen into disuse. Nobody really fasts on those Megillas Tanis days anymore. But if it is true, it would be the earliest record that there's some kind of a Jewish hanhaga or minhag that's associated with Christmas, that, or as it was called in Jewish sources, nittel. And with that, we'll segue a little bit to a different, more widespread and more well-known practice that's associated with nittel. And that is the practice of not learning Torah on Nittel Nacht. And this.
What does the word Nittel mean?
So the word Nittel meant Christmas.
That's what it meant.
Right. Yeah, that's what it means. Yeah. How it comes to mean that, I think, is a little bit of a mystery. The, you know, in some svarim, you see people saying pshatim that, you know, have to do with the Lashon Kodesh, like it's some form. Some people say that it's a Lashon of Nisla, meaning the person that was hanged, right? like a Tzlia. It's that would be Nittel with a Tav, and some people say something like because something was Nital, it wasn't that he was Nital from the world, he came into the world, but some goodness, I guess, with Nital was taken away from the world. But I think what's probably most likely the pshat is that it's not a Hebrew word at all. It means, it probably has to do with birth, as in natal meaning newborn.
Oh, wow.
So wow. That would be, you know, why it was called that. But the minhag, which today is found, as far as I know, only among Hasidim, but it's very strongly held among Hasidim, is that on Nittel Nacht, you don't learn Torah. There's no limud Torah on Nittel Nacht. That's the night of Christmas. They don't learn Torah. There's different minhagim from when till when, but some part at least of Nittel Nacht is a strong minhag not to learn Torah. And it should be emphasized that this minhag, it's strong by Hasidim, and that includes a lot of people that are never mevatel from Torah. I mean, even you know, chashuva tamid hachamim that were tremendous masmidim that didn't learn and didn't teach and were mevatel their base medrash from learning on Nittel Nacht. It was a minhag that was held very, very chashuv. But bizmanenu anu, you only find it really by the Hasidim. The Shai,
I actually heard one of the reasons behind it was because the guy who used to go to church at midnight, and if the Jews were walking around going to the Beis Medrash from Marav to whatever, that's when there was a lot of pogroms, and they were, so to say, they're better safe and stay at home. It's almost like a quarantine.
Right. That's one of the reasons. We're going to try to talk a little bit later in the shiur about some of the reasons that I've given for this minhag. And that's certainly might very well be the most compelling reason. But before the reasons, I'm interested in how far back does it go? How widespread was it? Nowadays, it's really contained, I think, more or less to, you know, among the Hasidim. But it does seem that, at least at some points, it was a little more widespread than that. How far back does it go? So there are some, you know, in some, I saw some Hasidic Sfarim that say, like, kind of very, very defensively, oh, you know, the people that say it's a newfangled thing, they don't know what they're talking about. It goes back to the times of the Rishonim, and it's mentioned in many Rishonim. And there's a whole list of Rishonim that I saw, you know, that somebody says he says to look in Rabbi Yoina and Rashbam B'Shem Rashi and Rabbi Huda Chassid and Shumas HaDeshen and Maracher Zeruah, and it's all fake. What do I mean it's all fake? What he was looking for and he was telling his readers is that these are all of these Rishonim mention Nittel. Now, Nittel was just a word that meant Christmas. And going back a long way, in the times of the Rishonim, in Ashkenaz, this was, you know, probably even predating Yiddish, but in Ashkenaz, that's what they called Christmas. And, of course, that comes up in halacha discussions, most primarily in Maseches Avodah Zarah, where the whole first parak is about Eidehem, right? Halachas that are in effect by the holidays of the Avdik Echavim. The Mishnah says, so there are restrictions on doing business with the Avdei Kechavim. That's the first mission of Maseches Avodah Zarah. So, of course, the Rishonim over there talk about how that impacts nowadays doing business with, we live among the Christians. Is it forbidden to do business with the Christians before Christmas? And so you see the word Nittel in some of the Rishonim at the beginning of Maseches Avodah Zarah. You see the Tshuvos and the Shumas HaDeshen about he says in his times there's a widespread minhag. Very interestingly, he says there was a widespread minhag for by the goyim to give gifts around Nittel, and which of course there still is nowadays. And he clears the shaila: is that forbidden under the halacha of lefnei edim asalasis v'lasis imahem? So yeah, there's no shortage of places in the Rishonim where you find the word Nittel in connection with Christmas and halacha shaylas that have to do with Christmas, but none of them have any shaychas to the references to Nittel Nacht being a time that you're not supposed to learn Torah. There's definitely no makaris and Rishonim for that. Now, there the closest that you'll get, there is one remez, which I want to share. Even though it's not really. I don't know how likely it is that it really is meant as a reference to this minhag, but it happens to be a fascinating remez. It's brought down in the Megala Amukais. The Megala Amukais is in the early 1600s, but he says that he's quoting from the Baal HaRekeach. The Baal HaRekeach is in the 1100s, in his Sefer Seidi Razaya. Now, the Rekeach, he wrote a Sefer Rekeach, which is a widely learned Sefer. He also wrote many Sifrei Kabbalah, which are not widely learned, but the Megala Amukos quotes very often from this sefer called the Seidi Razaya. But it's interesting to point out that nowadays there are editions of the Megala Amukos that have footnotes that, you know, people have done research on and checked out, and it seems that while we have some version of the Seidi Razaya, but our Seidi Razaya doesn't have a lot of the material that the Megala Amukos quotes from the Seidi Razaya. This piece that I'm about to say over, which is a fascinating piece, doesn't appear in our Seidi Razayas, but it's in the Megala Amukos. He says as follows. This is going to sound like a very far-fetched kind of remez. The Megala Amukos is full of these kinds of remezim. They're gematrias and reading into gematrias, but bear with him. There's a chokhmah behind it, and sort of a beauty behind it when you see the finished product. It says in Parashas Vayigash that Hashem called Yaakov, and He called him twice. Says Yaakov, Yaakov. There are three places in the Torah where you have such an expression. It says in Vayigash Yaakov, Yaakov. Abraham, it says in Parashas Vayera, right? Avraham, Avraham. And it says in Parashas Shemois at the Sne, Moshe, Moshe. Now the Medrash, the Shemois Rabbah there in Shemois, points out that there's a difference between the doubling of Moshe's name and the other two doublings, and that is that by Avram, there's a psik in between. In the truck, Avram, then there's a line, which means that the Balkari is supposed to pause, and then again, Avram. Yaakov, psik, Yaakov. By Moshe, it says Moshe without a psik. And the Medrash says, because Moshe Rabbeinu, it shows the Madrega, Moshe Rabbeinu, there was no hefsek in the Dvar Hashem. The Dvar Hashem, meaning his connection, his nevuah, his Torah, was on a higher level and has no hefsek. So the Rekeach says, so that means that when we read this pasuk in Parashas Vayigash, where it says Yaakov, psik Yaakov, so that psik should be seen as a hefsek. So it's saying Yaakov, hefsek Yaakov. Yaakov is gematria 182. So it says 182, hefsek 182. Two times 182 is 364. So it means that there's 364 days that there's limud haTorah, Yaakov, Ishtam, Yeshiva Halim, and one day of hefsek. And that's Tisha B'Av. That, right, one day out of 365 days of the year that there's no limud haTorah, that's merumas. In this pasuk, Yaakov, sick, Yaakov, 364 days, yes, and one day not. And then he adds, it is in the quote from the Seder Isaiah, he adds, and there's another 6 hours because of the tekufais. That's what he says, meaning that the year is not really 365 days. It's 365 and a quarter days. And in the Rekech, in the Seder Isaiah, he refers to that. He mentions that. And it's not clear, at least to me, again, these are hard pieces to read, it's not clear at all to me what he means to be pointing out about that, but he points out that there's an additional 6 hours. So, and the Megala Mukais brings this down. I guess, maybe the Megala Mukais himself is adding the point about the 6 hours. It's hard, I think, to tell exactly where in the paragraph, like right at the beginning of the paragraph, say, Sayyidina Isaiah. So, I don't know exactly whose observation that is about the 6 hours. But that's it. That's where the Megala Mukais ends. He just points out this, these 6 hours. So somebody that wrote footnotes on the Megala Mukais is Moirer, that this could be seen as a very geshmak remez to the idea that besides for Tisha B'Av, there's also 6 hours somewhere in the year that you're not allowed to learn. And that would be Nitelnacht. From when the sun goes down until Chatzos Halayla, which was probably the most widespread version of the minhag, from when it gets dark until Chatzos Halayla, so that's a quarter of a day. And the remez, Yaakov, Psik Yaakov, is a remez that there's a day that you're not allowed to learn Torah, Tisha B'Av. But it's really, really, if Yaakov is 364, so there's an extra day and 6 hours. So the remez really should say that there's a day and 6 hours that you're not allowed to learn Torah. So then it would be a remez to Nitelnacht. Now, the Megala Mukais, again, early 1600s, the Megala Mukais doesn't say that it's a reference to Nitelnacht. He just says that there's another 6 hours. Maybe he means that, maybe he doesn't, but whether or not he meant it, it is an interesting remez to this idea of Nitelnacht. Now, so, okay, where do you find it in any other svarim other than Chassidish svarim? So there... The one most clear, unequivocal reference is in the Chassam Sofer. There is a Tshuvas Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer was not Chassidish. He was in the Tkufa of Chassidim, the Chassam Sofer. This Tshuva actually was written, if I'm not mistaken, a little bit before the year 1800. It's from the earlier Tshuvas of Chassam Sofer. Although, it's interestingly, in publication, it's later. It's in the standard set of Shas Tshuvas Chassam Sofer. There are 6 volumes. This is not in the 6 volumes. It's in Chelek Ches. This was in the 1970s. They, people in Israel that were working on the Chassam Sofer's Torah were collecting other tshuvos that people were finding in various places. And at least the people that are putting it out vouch for it. They say that this is written in his handwriting. There's no question about the authenticity of it, they say. And he refers to the Shaila was about what's Pshat and Nitelnacht. Why don't we learn on Nitelnacht? And he responds to the Shaila. And he doesn't dismiss it. He doesn't say that it's not a good minug. In fact, he writes over there that there's 2 parts to the minug. He says he knows that some people also have this hakpada that they're not Mishamish Mitasam Balel Nitel, right? Some of the Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, there's no Tashmish Hamita. And some people say, and therefore the mikvois are closed. And that, Chassam Sefer calls a minhag shtus. He says that should be done away with. Now, my impression is that by the Hasidim, that's still held stark nowadays, including, I think, even the part about the mikvahs being closed. And certainly the hanhaga of the Isser Tashra Shamita that is brought down in Svarim, on Hilchas Taras Habayis, in the Chassidish Svarim, they bring this down. So that's still in practice nowadays. But Chassam Sefer calls that half a minhag shtus. But the part about not learning, he doesn't call a minhag shtus, and he talks about the reasons, which really will come to a little later in the shir. But here you have a non-chassid. He was, he's, what do we call him? An Oberlander. I mean, originally, really, he's German. He wasn't Misnagid. He never had shaykhs with the Chassidim. I don't know if he ever met Chassidim, really. He originated in Germany, and then he was eventually he was in Presburg, which was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Hasidus didn't really come to Hungary till a little bit later. Again, I don't know if he met the Hasidim, of course later on he met the Yismach Moshe, but that was later on. This is an early tshuva, 1797, and as far as I know, Hasidus had not come to Hungary yet at that time. So he really had to the best of my knowledge, no exposure to Hasidus, but was very familiar with the minhag of Nittel. The other makar, and these two makaris come from the Nittel Gavriel. The Sefer Nittel Gavriel is a multi-volume set on all the Yom Tovim. And in his volume on Chanukah, he has a chapter on Nittel. And he does a lot of good research. He finds a lot of hard-to-find Maror Mekayimos. And in addition to this Chassam Sefer, when he's looking for non-Hasidish sources for Nittel, or references to it, so he really comes up with two. There's this Chassam Sefer, and he brings a Makor Chaim of the Chavis Yair. So let's go off on a tangent a little bit, just to tell the story of the Makor Chaim of the Chavis Yair. The Chavis Yair was one of the big Paiske Ashkenaz in the 1600s. He's known from his Shalos HaTshuvos. Shalos HaTshuvos Chavis Yair is one of the classic Shalos HaTshuvos of the Acharonim. He also wrote a Sefer on Shulchan Aruch, which he considered his magnum opus. That was his most, his greatest Sefer. He called it Makor Chaim. And what's interesting is he wrote it. He was prepared for publication. And this story really intersects with a story that we were talking about, I think, a couple of weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago. We were talking about how the Magen Avraham and the Taz both wrote Pirushim and Aruch Chaim, but they were both not published in their lifetime. And then, what was his name? Somebody, Bess, he's the author of the Sifsei Chachamim on Rashi, and he wanted to print a new edition of the Shulchan Aruch, and he called it Magini Eretz because he included the Magen Avraham and the Magen David, which is what he called the Taz on Aruch Chaim. And the two of them both came out in the year 1698. I think it was 1692, maybe it was. Somewhere around there, maybe 1692. So the Chavis Yair writes that he wrote a Sefer on Aruch Chaim, which he called Makor Chaim, and it was being prepared for publication. And while it was in the middle of that process, the process meaning he wrote it, and his handwriting was very hard to read. And the printers said, we can't print something with your handwriting because we can't read it. So he needed to first hire somebody. He says he hired a bacher I don't think that necessarily meant somebody unmarried. A bacher, I think, meant somebody unlearned, meaning a bacher meant anyone could do this job. So he hired a bacher to rewrite the Sefer, and so that, somebody who had a good handwriting, and then the printers would print it. And while the bacher was in the middle of reprinting it, the Magini Eretz came out. That was the edition of the Shulchan Aruch with the Magen Avraham and the Taz. And then the Chavis Yair, his name, by the way, is Rav Yair Bachrach, and then the Chavis Yair, he got a hold of the Magini Eretz, and he said, okay, you could be for him, you could be against him, but you can't ignore him. I can't publish a Sefer on Aruch Chaim now that makes no mention of these two Pirushim, the Magen Avraham and the Taz, that just came out. A lot of the things that I wrote are now redundant because they're already there in the Magen Avraham or in the Taz. a lot of the things that I wrote are arguing with what it says in the Magen Avraham of the Taz. But I can't just say it now without confronting their arguments and, you know, and deciding who's right, who's wrong. So the whole sefer had to be reworked. And then, before it ended up being reworked, he passed away and it was never published. So it was a manuscript. It was an unpublished, that was his magnum opus, but it was an unpublished manuscript. This is from the 1690s till the 1980s. So it took almost 300 years. The Makor Chaim of the Chavis Yar, of Yari Bachrach, his peers, Makor Chaim, was unpublished until in the 1980s, Rav Yosef Buchsbaum, Olav Shalom, he was the founder of Machon Yerushalayim, was involved with, you know, putting out a lot of svarim, particularly liked to put out svarim that had, you know, that hadn't been published or hadn't been published well. And he writes in the Mavai that he walked in, he was one time in a svarim store in Mea Sharim, and the balabas of the svarim store told him, I have here, he said, I have an envelope, that I have here some old ksav yad. I don't know what it is. You'll be interested in it. He sold it to him for some small price. He took it home. He got to work on it. He figured out that, again, he was, you know, learned in this kind of stuff, and, you know, in svarim kind of bibliography. And he figured out that this was 30 pages. But it was 30 pages from this lost manuscript of Rav Yair Bachrach's Pirushan Arachayim. So he was very excited, and he wanted to see if there's any way to track down more of the manuscript. And he says that he was learning in a sefer from a Galician Rav in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who quotes the Makor Chaim. And he said, how could somebody in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania be quoting from the Makor Chaim? It was never published. He did a lot of research. He tracked down that the Ksav Yad was in Nicholsburg in the 1800s. Why? Because Yozeder of Mordechai Benet, he quotes from it. Mm-hmm. He said he found that in the whole Tekufa of all these centuries, of very few references to it. And he tracked down that it was in Nicholsburg in the 1800s. And then a Rav in Pittsburgh was quoting from it. So he wrote a letter to that Rav in Pittsburgh. It was returned to sender, deceased. He missed him. Right? The Rav died. He got in touch with the children of the Rav and said, I want to know how your father was quoting from this Makor Chaim. They said, okay, we'll look through his svarim. He doesn't have any such sefer. But we know that our father, he likes to visit the library of the JTS in New York. So then he got in touch with JTS in New York and found that they had the manuscript. Wow. So he worked out how to get it from them and published it. So Machon Yerushalayim put it out in 1984, first time that it was ever published. Now, okay, so that's the story behind the Makor Chaim. Now, the story behind this, but there's still more. This reference, again, the Nitig Avriel says you want to find the non-Hasidic sources that bring down Nizelnach, Makor Chaim. In Simen Kuf Nun Hei. So the Bachar that was rewriting it, he got till Simen Kuf Nun Gimel. And he stopped.
Oh my God.
So now, so the Machon Yerushalayim, they write that because he stopped and Rav Yair Bachrach didn't want it to go to waste, so he, some of it never got rewritten, but what he did for, I think, everything after Kuf Nun Gimel was he wrote something called Kitzer Psukim or Kitzer Halachis. I think Kitzer Halachis, in which he wrote like in bullet point form the what he discussed in the Makor Chaim. It's more like a catalog than anything else, just what he talks about. So then when Machon Yerushalayim published it, so they published up till Kuf Nun Gimel from the neat handwriting of the Bachar. After Kuf Nun Gimel, from the dense, difficult handwriting, but they worked on it and they deciphered it and published it from his own Ksav Yad. And they also, on those Simanim, they published the Kitzer Halachis. Now, on Simen Kuf Nun Hei, there is no Makor Chaim. There's no, like, long version of, you know, discussions of Makor Chaim. But for some reason, there is Kitzer Halachis, and there are two versions of it. there are, and they write in the Mavoi that there are some simonim where there are two versions. It seems that he wrote it twice. Two versions of the bullet point Kitzur Halachais. On the, now, on the words, what's Simon Kufnin Hei? Simon Kufnin Hei, it's an interesting simon in Shulchan Aruch. This is also one of the less learned simonim. It says that when you finish davening, you're supposed to go to the Beis Medrash because you have to be kaveh itim every day. That's Simon Kufnin Hei, the mitzvah of the halacha of kviyas itim l'tayra. And it says over there that you should have a time every day that you learn v'loya virenu, and you shouldn't let it pass. On the words v'loya virenu, there's a bullet point. And it says, minhag hagoy marlap, u'minhag bitul halimod b'leil chaga plainis. Yeah, okay. Hagoy marlap, don't know who it is, somebody that was known in his time. It says over there that it stands for Ablaib Prague. I don't know who Ablaib Prague is, but he must have had some interesting minhag about his Kviyas Itim L'Torah that the Chavos Yair wanted to write about, but we don't know, he never wrote it. We just have the bullet point. And it says, minhag hagoyim marlap, u'minhag bitul halimud b'leil chag ha'plainis, which certainly sounds like that nitzel nacht. In the other nusach of the Kitzur Halachais on that simin, the bullet point on lo yavirenu says, minhag hagoyim marlap. That's all it says. So it's in one of the two versions. So, okay, you know, then you have to start wondering what are these two different versions, and you know, is there any possibility that one is more authentic than the other? Again, this is such an elusive topic to find any reference to, and not, you know, this by the Chavos Yair, this would make it 100 years earlier than the Chasam Sofer. So the earliest reference that we have anywhere is this Shuvas Chasam Sofer, 1797. Then, 100 years earlier, in a Sefer that never got published, in a Simin that never got written, in the Kitzur Halachis that there's two versions of, but we don't know exactly why there's two versions, one of the two versions refers to Nitzel Nacht. Okay? Maybe.
How do you know
it doesn't mean Tisha B'Av? He says, Leil Chag HaPlainis. First of all, Tisha B'Av is not just by night, and he would never call Tisha B'Av Chag HaPlainis. Right. So,
the Chasam Sofer doesn't say where he got it from?
He refers to it as if it's a known minhag.
He doesn't discuss origin.
He discusses reasons. He doesn't discuss origin.
Maybe the other version was censored.
Maybe. Although it seems that, censored by who? The manuscript was never printed. It wasn't censored by Machon Yerushalayim. Now, although he mentioned censored, the truth is that it's a very good point. When I talk about how it's so elusive to find references to it, it's not really a kasha. Let's assume that everyone kept nittel. All the Jews in the world, let's say, in the 1600s kept nittel. And so you'll say, so why isn't it written anywhere in the Paiskim? Maybe they didn't want to write it because it was a very sensitive subject and anything that was printed was looked over. So it makes sense that they were trying not to write it. So it's not a big kasha. How come we don't find any references to it? But maybe it's a little kasha. At least it's an observation. All right, you're trying to figure out how far back it goes. L'maisa, you really can't figure it out. You have these two references, the Chasam Sofer in 1797, this Chavos Yair about 100 years earlier. And then after that, it's written about in Chassidish Svarim. Before we come to the discussion about the reasons for it, so one last point of curiosity. I say that by the Hasidim it's Nahug. What about by non-Hasidim? So it does seem, again, from the Chasam Sofer, it seems that it wasn't limited to the Hasidim. That the Germans, maybe the Austrians, I don't know where he was when 1797, but at least the Germans, because he came from Frankfurt, and he says that he heard from his Rebbe was in Frankfurt. So it seems that we do have evidence that it was practiced, this minig of Nitzel Nacht was practiced in Germany in the 1700s. What about in Litta? Was there ever a minhag of Nitzel Nacht in Litta? Now, the Litvaks, I think, will tell you no way, no how. They
Chabad,
and certainly.
Chabad
is Russia, but they're Hasidim. But I mean the Litvish, the Mesnagdim in Litta. The Nitin Gavriel, in a little bit of a, again, he has a chapter on the topic, he brings down that the Chazon Ish had some strong words against Nitl, you know, against following this practice, and he says, you know, the author of the Nitin Gavriel, he says, I can't believe it, I can't understand how he can say such a thing. I, you know, fine, it's not his minig, you know, let it not be his minig, but how could he criticize, I think he says something like, I can't believe that he said it, to go and criticize a minig of, you know, of Chashuv Yidden. But it doesn't really seem so surprising to me that the Chazon Ish would have been critical of this minhag. But is there any reference to this minhag being in existence in Lithuania? So there is one Maramakim that I'm not able to track down. Maybe somebody else is. Yeah, in the Svarim that I looked in a few different Svarim that you know, try to like bring you all the raid, all the material. Again, I think of real being one of them, but there are some others that collect Maramakim based on the Inyan of Nitl. I didn't see anything from any Litvish sources. But I remember that when I was a kid, I had a book, an English book, called Stories by Judaeus. Now, Judaeus was a pen name for a German writer, Naftali Hertz Ehrman. There were a lot of, in Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's Germany, there was a big emphasis on producing literature for, you know, kosher literature. Which, interestingly, Yisrael Salanter, you know, he felt bad that in Eastern Europe they didn't have a similar thing. When he spoke to Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, he said that, you know, he complimented him on that's one of the things that he was able to create in Western Europe, and he felt bad that they didn't have anything like that in Eastern Europe. So one of the people that wrote these stories in German was Rav Naftali Hertz Ehrman. And in I don't know, in the 1970s, Mistama, this one of the English publishing companies put out an English translation of some of his short stories, and it was called Stories by Judaeus, because that was his pen name. One of the stories, and I had it as a kid. I liked the book very much. I remember I read it, I liked it. One of the stories in the book was called Nittelnacht in Vilna. That was one of the stories in the book. Now, I can't track down the book. It's not, you know, the last time it was published was in the 1980s. There's no electronic version of it anywhere. I was able to find, you know, a catalog of, you know, you can find online that the book exists, but you can't find it electronically, and I don't have it anymore. And, you know, maybe some of you have it. But what?
Bookspan.
Maybe he'll have it. Maybe. But he had a short story called Nittelnacht in Vilna. And to the best of my recollection, what I think the story was a conversation, I mean, I think a fictional conversation, you know, between Rabbi Shaul Salanter and the Rashash of Shmuel Strashen. I really might be wrong. Again, I'm trying to remember from a story that I read as a kid, but my recollection is that he writes a long conversation between the two of them, and it's meant as, you know, it's fiction, it's historical fiction. What he meant to be showing was, you know, what it sounds like when, you know, the Sichas Chulin Shel Talmidei Chachamim, and how they were talking all about mundane topics, but somehow it was a very inspiring or uplifting conversation. And I just wonder, you know, if he's writing, does that mean, he's a Yid that lived in the 1800s, was he under the impression that in Vilna they were keeping Nittelnacht? Now, even if he was under that impression, that doesn't mean that it was true, but it would be meaningful if somebody at that time was saying that was the case, so that would be a meaningful maramakam of sorts. Okay, but I can't, you know, I don't know if I'm remembering it correctly altogether, and even if it is correct, how much is it worth already? It's somebody in Germany writing historical fiction, so Lav Dafka gets worth anything, but I think it's an interesting maramakam. Okay, now that's about that's all I have about the how widespread it was, how far back it goes, which is all really very shrouded in mystery. What are the reasons for this bizarre minhag? This idea that on the night that on the day that Yeshua was born, we abstain from limud Torah. So I think what seems to be the most widespread reason given is that it has to. This comes primarily from the Sefer Kabbalah. Is that it has to do with the idea of the klipos, the koiches atumah, it's a very bad night in the spiritual world. It's a night that the bad forces have a very strong upper hand, right? What the mukubalim call the klipos. And so, and this is a concept that I don't have any understanding of at all, but what some of the mukubalim say is that the limana Torah that you learn on that night would be caught by the klipos and would end up being Moisef Koyach to their Pamalia. And so we avoid learning Torah on that night. That's it's sort of attributed to the B'nai Yisachar, not in his Sefer, but elsewhere he said it, or he wrote it somewhere else, and other Kabbalah Kesvarim. That's one possibility. The Chassam Sefer, again, he got a Shaila about this very topic. The Shaila was, why don't we learn on Nitzelnacht? And he says that what he was mekabel from his Rebbe was that because it's a bad day, so it has like a Tisha B'Av kind of a quality to it. And just like a Tisha B'Av, because B'kudei Hashem Yisharim Masam Chilev, Torah gives Simcha, and we stay away from Simcha, so you don't learn Torah on Tisha B'Av. So on this night also, because there's an element of Avelos, because of the terrible event that happened, So we stay away from learning Torah because Kodesh Hashem Sham Chilev. Some Sefer says, I don't think that's a good pshat, because I don't know about you, but you know, you could, I know my for myself and many, many other Chachamim, we don't sit around Tisha B'Av playing cards or doing other things. We learn Inyanei Avelos. There are things you're allowed to learn on Tisha B'Av. So if Nitl is to be treated as Tisha B'Av, so learn Inyanei Avelos, learn the Dvarim Arayim Shabbi Yirmiyav, Shabbi Iyayiv, like it says in Shulchan Aruch, it's supposed to learn on Tisha B'Av. But to not learn anything, that it does not resemble the halach of Tisha B'Av. So he doesn't think that's the pshat. So he has a very creative pshat. He says that it's his own idea. He has no maseir on this. But he says that he's speculating that maybe this is the pshat. And that on the night of Nittel, so there's something called Midnight Mass, right? At least there used to be, some of there still is in some circles, that they go to church for a sermon at midnight. And what are they?
All the Roman Catholics
do that. All the Roman Catholics do that. Okay. So what do they hear at the sermon? So, you know, when they're not hearing, you know, kill the Jews, what are they hearing? They're hearing about, you know, kindness and charity and humility and all good things, right? If people go in any religion, they go to their house of worship, they're hearing good things, kindness, humility, charity, and that's all good. So there's a hiseiris tshuva in the middle of the night by the Umay Sa'ilam, and meanwhile the Yidin are sleeping, you know, al mitasam. So it's a kitrug. In Lamala, there'd be a kitrug on Klal Yisrael. Everybody else is on a higher madrega, and the Yidin are not. So the idea was that there should be a super mishmar that starts at midnight on the night of Nitol, that the Leim Neteir should learn that night. For starting from Chatzos, when they go to Mass and they're going to hear a nice sermon, we should be learning Torah. But it's not reasonable to say, you know, to learn the whole night. So the idea was that everybody should push off their Sturm from the first half, and that usually the Talmidei Chachamim sit and learn till it gets late and then they go to sleep. So tonight they should turn it around. They should go to sleep the first half of the night and then get up at midnight and then learn until the morning. That was the idea.
That part, by the way, everybody leaves out.
Oh, right. So he said, "Bervoy Sayonim."
That's what they used to do.
What happened? Yeah. Well, we don't know that they used to. He's saying
okay,
the Chassam Sofer doesn't say that he sees such a minhag. That minhag didn't exist. He was speculating that was the original minhag, and then what happened was a corruption of the minhag. That all people remembered was that we don't learn that night. They were about to their starim, and the other part got forgotten about. Maybe some people still did it, but maybe the Chassam Sofer personally did because this was his idea, but he doesn't say that that's the old minhag. He says that that's his theory for how the minhag of not learning on Nitol came about.
The Muslims that one 5 times.
Yeah, so why don't we do that? It shouldn't be a kitrig. I hear, right? Certainly we don't go doing so many things because of this consideration, but we do find this consideration in some places. I mean, most notably, you know, the Medrash on Yoina talks about that the whole reason why Yoina ran away was so that there shouldn't be a kitrug on Klal Yisrael, that the Goyim do tshuva more easily than the Yidden do. I think that's the makar for this concept. So That's the third pasuk. Again, the first was the Kabbalah that the Torah gets caught by the Klipais. The second was like Tisha B'Av, Pekudeshem, Yisharim, Mazam Chileb. The third Indian is that we sleep the first half of the night, so you get up and learn the second half of the night. And the fourth, which is brought down in the Tameh HaMenhagim, and this is probably the most straightforward explanation, is what Robert said before, that it was a dangerous night to be out. Mm-hmm. And that which would mean that the original Minhag wasn't really not to learn Torah per se, but it was not to go to shul. And that's where the learning happened. The Yidden went to shul, to the Beis Medrash, and there were different chaburis. There was the people that learned Gemara, there was the people that learned Mishnayos, the people that learned Ein Yaakov. Everybody had their chabur, but they met in the shul every night. But Christmas Eve, they didn't go to shul because it was dangerous to go out. So they stayed home, and that would be the origin of Nittel. Now, so these are four of the reasons that are given. Now, what an interesting nafkamina between the reasons is that there's a big shaila that a lot of the Chassidim, the Chassidish Svarim and the Chassidish Rebbes, there's a big controversy about when to be noyeg, the meaning of Nittel. And the controversy arose because a lot of the Chassidim come from places in Europe where they kept the Orthodox Church with the Orthodox calendar rather than the Gregorian calendar. So the background on that, Bekitzer, is that the calendar originally, right, we know the Gregorian calendar has a leap year every fourth year. Why, right? February 29th, every fourth year. Why every fourth year? Because if the solar year is 365 days and 6 hours, so we have 365 days in a year, but every year there's an extra 6 hours. So after 4 years, the 6 hours, 6 + 6 + 6 + 6 equals 24. So after 4 years, there's an extra day. So we make a leap year every fourth year. That's the idea. But it's not really so accurate. Really, the year is not 365 days and 6 hours. It's 365 days and 5 hours and 49 minutes and some odd seconds. So that the precise amount is really off by about 11 minutes a year. The year is is 11 minutes too long, which means that the year was falling behind the seasons. And in the year 1582, when the scholars, the scientists, figured out exactly what was going on and how to fix it, so at that point they said that from the time that the current calendar began to be used, these 11 minutes have added up. 11 minutes a year have added up to 10 days. So in the year 1582, the Pope Gregory, decided that we're taking 10 days out of this year. So it was October 15th, and then at midnight it became October 26th. They skipped 10 days in October in 1582.
No.
Yeah. Okay. And then to correct that, to ensure that it shouldn't...
Julian calendar, right. Or the Gregorian.
Then the Gregorian calendar. And then to ensure that it wouldn't happen again, they made a cheshbon that these 11 minutes a year add up to about 3 days every 400 years. So the calendar, as we have it now, actually we have a leap year every fourth year, but that's skipped three times every 400 years. But it hasn't happened in anybody here's lifetime, because the way that it's set up is that when the year ends with a multiple of 4, right? 4, 8, 12, 16, 20. So it's supposed to be a leap year. The century year is also a multiple of 4. So a century year should also be a leap year. But the Gregorian calendar has it that on the century year, we skip the leap year except for every fourth century. Now, the only century year that we've seen was the year 2000, which is a fourth century. So it was a leap year. So in our lifetime, it was always every fourth year is a leap year. But the year 1900 was not a leap year. And the year 2100 also will not be a leap year. 2100, 2200, and 2300 will not be a leap year. 2400 will be a leap year again. And with that, we're taking 3 days out every 400 years, and that's supposed to adjust for the 11 minutes a year. And that's the new calendar. But it wasn't made up by the Pope. Obviously, it was made up by the secular scholars who told him, the astronomy, the math. But he's the one that shtelled it avek. That's why it's called the Gregorian calendar, which means that naturally, if you don't hold to the Pope, then you can't accept the Gregorian calendar. So he made this calendar. The Catholic countries adopted it. Originally, the Protestant countries said, no way, that's your chumra. We don't hold like that. Eventually, but Lamaisa, it made a lot of sense, and it does fix the calendar. So eventually, the Protestant countries came to take it on. Also, I think that happened in the 1700s. In America, in American documents, they switched to the Gregorian calendar in the 1750s, meaning before the Revolution, before there was the United States of America. But in American history, sometime in the 1700s, they made the switch, and I think that's when the Protestant countries, for the most part, made the switch. But there's a different church that's separate from the Catholics, and that's the Eastern Church, which is a much older separation. It goes back to the 300s. You had Rome and you had Byzantium as the two centers of the Christian world. So the Catholics came from Rome, and then they eventually broke up into the Catholics and the Protestants. But the Eastern Church never had any shaykhs to Catholicism, never had any shaykhs to the Pope. So they weren't going to change anything just because the Pope said so. So they stayed with their old calendar, which means that their calendar was 10 days ahead.
What's a lot now, of churches in Yerushalayim are from the Eastern.
The Armenians, right, the Armenians are from the Eastern, right. Now, eventually, like by the 20th century, all the countries adopted the Gregorian calendar in their civil calendar because you can't do business otherwise. I mean, you have the rest of, Russia can't not be on the Gregorian calendar. They can't write checks for other people in the world to use. So eventually, they all adopted it, but they made this divide that they're only adopting it for civil purposes, but not for religious purposes. So they have the Gregorian calendar. They have December 25th, the same time that America has December 25th, but they're not going to celebrate Christmas on that day because that would be changing the date of Christmas because of what the Pope said, and they don't hold to the Pope. So their Christmas is calculated based on the old calendar, which never took out the 10 days, which by now is 11 or 12 days. So their Christmas is, I think, on January 6th. Now, why is that of interest to us? It's not really of interest to us, but to those people that are Noeg Nittol, so a lot of the Hasidim, a lot of the Rebbes came from Russia, which means that they were they grew up being Noeg Nittol, or more importantly, their Zaydas, right, that they makabel everything from, and they don't want to change anything, their Heilige Zaydas were Noeg Nittol on January 6th. And then they came to America. And in America, they celebrate Nittol on December 25th. So which is the real Nittol? That's a big controversy by the Hasidim. And you have rabbis that go one way, rabbis that go the other way, and there are some that go both ways. Yes, there are. I'm told somebody told, again, I was talking about this on Shabbos, and somebody said that he was recently, I think maybe this year, that he was somewhere in Chabad and there was an announcement that we keep both Nittles. It's a hot topic in all Hasidic circles, but the Ha'ara is based on the reasons that we just went through that it very likely should be toloi on the various reasons. Meaning, Lamashal, according to the reasons of the Tamei HaMenhagim, that it's because you're afraid that there'll be violence in the streets. So, okay, first of all, you shouldn't even.
6, the Trump, is that connected? Oh.
Okay, maybe. That's the conspiracy theory wing of the Shir. Of course, one could suggest that if you live in a fairly safe place like New York City, and right now we're not feeling so safe with the current, but still, I mean, historically speaking, a relatively safe place. People are not really concerned about going out in the street, and it's no worse on Christmas than any other day of the year. So to suggest that maybe the whole thing should be bottled nowadays, of course, is a very reasonable suggestion. But even assuming you don't want to go there, you want to consider it a Heilige Minhag, and therefore we're not going to change anything. But what day to be knowing? According to that time, it has to go by the local Christmas. It's not going to be totally on what used to be Christmas by the Zayda. It's the local Christmas. According to the time of the violence in the streets, or the time of the Chassam Sofer of midnight mass, it should go by the local Christmas. Mash'en Kain, according to the B'nai Yisachar's reason, that it's because of the koyach of the klipois, so then it's really what's be'etzem, it's not what the goyim in New York are noyig, but in the Olam HaSol Yoinim, when is it Christmas there? And if that, so then I suppose the Hasidim would say that that should be totally on whatever the Zayda did, right? The Etzem Dika Nittel is if they had Heilige Zaydas, whenever they were Neig Nittel, that's what they'll consider Nittel. Mm-hmm. So that would be an argument in favor of going with the, you know, with the Russian date of January 6th. So that Shaila would be totally on these different reasons. I'll just end off, we don't really have time for a whole nother discussion, but I just want to end off by being Ma'ira, and then we're going to talk about what's the Be'etzem Dika Nittel, like, you know, where, when does the Klipa really have this Hisgabrus? So that assumes that anything really happened historically on December 25th, that it's really the day that Yeshu was born. So then, you know, Al Pi Kabbalah, you could say that there's some kind of a Hisgabrus of Koichei Satuma, but the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah refers to the holiday, the Roman holiday that was held on the Yom HaTekufa, Tekufas Teves, which falls out around this time of year. It's really December 21st. And a lot of historians say that when the early Christian church was trying to bring in supporters, they were trying to spread their word and you know, the Roman population, they wanted to attract them, but the Roman population was, you know, wanted to hold on to a lot of their old practices, and they were holidays that they liked very much, and they didn't want to join this new religion that doesn't have the old holiday. So they co-opted the holiday. They said, okay, you have a holiday this time of year, the Yule time holiday, so we'll make it into a Christian holiday. And they gave it a religious significance, they called it a birthday, and that's where Christmas comes from. But there, according to that, if that's true, there isn't any kind of old tradition that he was really born on that day. In which case, it's hard to say that it's a day of a Gvaldi, you know, his Gabrus of the Koyches Atumah. That means
that Svartim would have to hold it too.
Why?
Because if it has to do with Tekufos, then it affects everybody, not just Jews who live
in Christian lands.
Right, but there were no Christians.
Yeah, but this Mishnah in Avodah Zarah that mentions the pagan holidays, that doesn't say anything about the Minig of Nittel. That just says there was an old holiday on that time. Actually, but the Minig of Nittel.
They did have Christians because in Spain there were Christians, so never mind what I said.
Okay.
So Buddha has a bigger following than.